Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a reading and conversation presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker is Romanian author Mircea Cartescu. The discussion is moderated by Delia Agriana, assistant professor at the University of Bucharest and visiting lecturer in Harvard's Department of Comparative Literature. We begin with an introduction by AGNI editor Sven Burkitz.
The European Voices series is premised on the notion, which is articulated so very well by essayist Rebecca Solnit, that ideas originate, quote, not in bureaucratic chambers, but in the street, where they are picked up and represented by artists, writers, activists, and intellectuals in a manner that sparks public discourse and seeds future politics, unquote. So this is the latest iteration in an ongoing series of conversations with European artists and writers that the Center for the Study of Europe, formerly the Institute for Human Sciences, and AGNI have been hosting since 2004, when we launched Poetry and Politics, quote unquote, exploring questions at the intersection of politics and culture. Moderating tonight's event is Delia Agriana, assistant professor at the University of Bucharest and a visiting lecturer at Harvard's Department of Comparative Literature. She's currently working on a book project on oniric literature as world literature, with a focus on writers like Jorge Luis Borges, Fernando Pessoa, Orhan Pamuk, Milorad Pavic, and Mircea Cartescu. Welcome, everyone, and we'll get our evening started. Thanks.
Good evening, and welcome to what I hope is going to be more than European voices. I would like to convince you tonight that we are listening to world voices. After I will do my very short introduction, only 12 minutes, I checked that before, Mircea is going to do a reading in Romanian, and then I'm going to read the same passage in English. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of many communist regimes marked a turning point, both for the European and world literary maps. Confronted with a new world, literary studies had to rethink their premises and redefine their notion of Europe, which, up to then, had largely meant Western Europe and the literatures of a few dominant powers. 1989 was a threshold for many Central and Eastern European writers who came out into a world where they had to rethink their geopolitical and literary identity as well as their audience. For Mircea Cartescu, too, 1989 was a symbolical threshold in his life as a writer. Aptly and most prophetically, a diary entry from January 3, 1990 tells of a dream where a door opens in a blinding wall. And I quote, "Here's a dream I never told. It's old. I was in front of an immense wall, the obtuse facade of a building like those in the Valley of Kings. White wall, blinding, slightly inclined on the upper part, like a pyramid. All of a sudden, a gate opened in it, and through it, I entered a library as big as a warehouse." What he enters, in fact, through the gate in the wall, like in Kafka's dream of the multiple gates opening in the Great Wall of China, is the space of world literature, resonant with Borges's Library of Babel. At the same time, Mircea Cartescu reads, quite prophetically again, the Divine Comedy, as he writes in his diary, that this is the only book one can stand to read after a revolution, and at the same time, fragments from Franz Kafka's diary. For the members of the 80s generation in Romania, the West meant a cultural dream and an escape from the political turmoil through reading and writing. Mircea Cartescu started as the leading poet of this generation, which paradoxically brought to Romanian literature a postmodernism in the absence of postmodernity. Against the dystopian reality of what was for Romania the darkest decade of the communist regime. For the writers of the 80s generation, poetry was the ultimate reality with capital letter, and for Mircea Cărtărescu, it led to the development of his specific literary formula, which is his hallmark today, oneric or dream literature, that challenges all boundaries of genres, creating a new type of fiction. Blinding is the fruit of a decade of writing that reworks his two major pre-1989 projects. On the one hand, it's the poetic prose in the novel Nostalgia, and on the other, it's the rhymed verse of his epic, The Levant, which is a rewriting of the history of Romanian poetry in all its major genres and poetic forms. The Levant's ambitious play on languages and dialects, and its playful intertextual rewriting matches James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. Going beyond both Nostalgia and The Levant, the trilogy Blinding challenges again all genre boundaries. It appears as a monstrous Dantesque fiction with a poetic core. As Mircea Cărtărescu writes about it in his diary, it's a novel as an expanded poem or a sonnet novel. Mircea Cărtărescu has been hailed by the French journal Lire as the Borges of European literature, but Mircea Cărtărescu is perhaps closer to Franz Kafka in his total rejection of the political and the social, and at the same time in his visceral need to write. This makes him something of an odd man out in the post-communist literary landscape, where intellectuals coming from the former communist countries have often been expected to play also a militant role in speaking in the name of Western political values. Mircea Cărtărescu's answer to this is a return to the world of dreams, of the inner psychic life, as he writes in his diary, "When all will turn to the social, the historic, and the political, I will stick to the psychic, che muove il sole e l'altre stelle," he says, quoting Dante in the original. Cărtărescu has published more than 2 dozen books and has been translated into 17 languages after 1989, though mainly as a fiction writer, even if he is first known in the 80s as the strongest voice ever in Romanian poetry. Yet, with Blinding, Mircea Cărtărescu proves that poetry can travel through oneric literature, which is a new genre crossing all genres. Poetry becomes redefined as nostalgia, unfolding within the dream structure of the narrative as found in the postmodern novel, which, for Mircea Cărtărescu, is, I quote from his diary again, the poetry of our times. Cărtărescu is known to the U.S. audience through the poetry collection of 1999, Bebop Bebe, and the 2005 Nostalgia, published by New Directions and Julian Simelian's translation. His works have been awarded several prestigious international prizes, including the prize of the Haus der Kultur in der Welt in Berlin in 2012 for the second volume of Blinding, and this year he was awarded the Swiss Spiecher Literaturpreis Lueck. At the same time, the French translation of Nostalgia was shortlisted for Médicis Étrangère, and 2 years ago, he was one of the top 10 candidates for the Nobel, according to Ladbrokes' list. And during the past 3 years, he was a constant candidate nominated for the Nobel. Blinding has been translated into 10 languages, including French, German, Spanish, Dutch, Norwegian, Hebrew, and Swedish, and after the massive success it had on the German language market through Gerhard Czeka's and Ferdinand Leopold's translation, Blinding comes now to a new life in English in Sean Cotter's translation. Aptly, the first country that Cărtărescu visited after 1990 was the United States, and it is here that he began thinking of a new life through translation and also to shape the trilogy we see today. And he writes about his coming to the U.S. that to enter that fabulous world like a barbarian in the Roman Empire is more than I could ever wish for. As his work is translated into the world languages, Mircea Cărtărescu no longer belongs just to a national literature or a geographical area, the Balkans, Central and Eastern Europe, but rather thinks of himself as citizen of Europe or of the world at large. And I quote again from his diary, "I miss America and Paris. I'm no longer from here completely. I jumped on another spire. I already feel citizen of the world. In 20 years, maybe I will become one." Read today in 2013, this diary entry from 1991 holds true. He has become a world author. not belonging to a country, but to the world. English has had a special role for Mircea Cărtărescu since 1989, as he writes in his diary that I wish we could live there in English forever. I have begun to read in English like in my own native language. I am preparing to become, either here or there, in the US, a nowhere man. Speaking in Hamburg in 2003 on what it means to be European, Mircea Cărtărescu argued that for a writer, being European means reading the big names of world literature and not the national, local specific. Against the market pressure to retail local Eastern European color, Mircea Cărtărescu proposes a Europe that becomes an imaginary homeland, where the ideal community of writers is a library organized in intellectual networks of affinities, each time different. A Europe having the shape of his brain, to quote this title, like the butterfly structure of the trilogy Blinding. That is, the left wing, we have today that, and we are still waiting for the body and the right wing. Being European doesn't point to a geographical identity, but rather to a cultural one. And Mircea Cărtărescu writes in his diary that it's obvious there exists something which underlies tautologically all works which could be included under the name of high culture, whether they might be created, or no matter how contaminated they might be with other culture, and that thing is, Mircea Cărtărescu says, the European spirit. From this point of view, García Márquez is a European, Pynchon is a European, Cavabata is a European, perhaps not through their attitude and ideology, but no doubt in the great collective subconscious of the work of art, in the philosophy underlying the field of knowledge as the ancient Greeks conceived it first. In their presuppositions, in what is not expressed, but is determinant for a literary work. Mircea Cărtărescu has always engaged with ambitious projects, be they poetry or fiction, renewing the literary form of the epic in rhymed verse in the epic The Levant, or the structure of the novel, crossing the genre borders between autobiography, fiction, short stories, and the novel. The Levant and Blinding tell two parts of Romania's history. The birth of the nation-state through the liberation from the Ottoman Empire and the birth of a country from the Soviet dominion in a newly globalized world. In Blinding, the central character moves the poet of the epic one step further. The narrator Mircea is an inveterate dreamer and a poet who enlarges his own individual memory to encompass the memory of his ancestors, both the real and the imagined ancestors, in poetry and fiction, and takes this memory on a global map. However, to be part of world literature is also a question of how one uses one's language. If it had been written in a peripheral language, Joyce's Ulysses might have well been non-existent outside its national borders. Mircea Cărtărescu is very much aware of the fact that for less widely circulated languages, such as Romanian, the translatable power of vision should come before the less translatable play of language. He distinguishes between Romanian writers who broke up the linguistic barriers and mental borders separating the West and the East, and I'm thinking here of Tristan Tzara, Eugen Ionesco, and Emil Cioran, and the Romanian writers who, as Mircea Cărtărescu writes, remained unfortunately captive in the mirage of an immensely expressive but untranslatable language. And we are thinking here of the avant-garde poets like Urmuz, Arghezi, and Blaga. The hierarchy of languages in the international field is a reality, and to be able to reach outward, there are only two options: shifting to a global language or being translated into one. The trilogy of Blinding transforms a world of historical and political borders into a world of words without borders. In the period preceding the beginning of Blinding, a recurrent dream in different variants appears in Mircea Cărtărescu's diary. An adolescent looking through the window of his parents' communist apartment at the Bucharest of his dreams, dreaming of its colossal subterranean buildings, until the great wall of another communist bloc deprives him of his infinite oneric space. This scene becomes then the opening of the trilogy and a structuring symbol of the narrative. It's the symbol of communism, which destroys the interwar Bucharest. It's the symbol of Romania's political isolation in the Eastern communist bloc. It's the symbol of all barriers imposed on a creative individuality in its relation to the world, the Berlin Wall, and, last but not least, Pink Floyd's The Wall, itself a symbol of geopolitical, moral, and ideological barriers that need to be crossed to liberate the human mind. Thinking of Blinding as a diary enormously dilated, as he writes in his diary, where dream and memory totally overlap, poetry takes a very personal meaning for Mircea Cărtărescu. It means dreams, memory, childhood, nostalgia, and melancholy, and the way to redemption. It's the opposite to maturity. And he writes in his diary, "I'm still refusing maturity. I fight it with poetry. One way or another, I will return to poetry." The history covered by Blinding spans a century and a half, starting with the mythical tale of his mother's Bulgarian ancestors in mid-19th century, continuing with the years of World War II, when his mother moves from the country to Bucharest to work in a factory, and leading up to the communist years of the 1989 revolution. Sean Cotter's translation captures the distinct voice of each of the three narrative levels on which the novel proceeds. There is a first narrative level by someone named Mircea in the last years of the 80s, diving into his childhood and adolescence, and that is a Proustian voice of melancholy and nostalgia, a voice resonant of the adult narrator voice in the novel Nostalgia. And then there is a third-person narrative describing his childhood and years before his birth, his mother's distant past, as well as her ancestors, which is resonant of García Márquez's visionary Macondo. And there is, thirdly, another third-person narrative of the essay-like pages, which is reminiscent of Thomas Pynchon. A strong religious and encyclopedic drive organizes the trilogy we see today. Structurally, both the Divine Comedy and Finnegan's Wake are obliquely brought together to shape the trilogy, with an ending of each part playing on the world in the title Mirrig Dante's Stele, Blinding or the Empyrean Light. The trilogy results in what Joyce would call in Finnegan's Wake an apocalypse, where the apocalypse is a new genesis, just like Finnegan's Wake ending is, in fact, the beginning of the novel. Many Central and Eastern European writers explore questions of identity, memory, and the past, which is a natural outcome, perhaps, of their isolation behind the Iron Curtain, but also an effect of local political histories which need to be rewritten after the fall of the communist regimes. But in Cărtărescu's writing, these questions are explored with different instruments and to a different outcome than in Peter Nadasch's or Peter Esterházy's writings. For Mircea Cărtărescu, history is no longer social and political history, not a mere family chronicle with its parallel stories and interwoven structure, but rather a solution to redefine the human being as much as a creation of its past and also as its creator. History here is a history of dreams, fiction, myths, and memory, which hold the key to a Kafka metamorphosis. In an essay presented in Hamburg during an international colloquium in 2003, Mircea Cărtărescu gave a striking personal account. He had dreamed of Europe as a Borgesian library having the shape of his brain. Today, after 10 years have elapsed, and Mircea Cărtărescu's works have traveled throughout the world, we could easily substitute the world for Europe, and the passage would read as following. There are many worlds in time and space, in dreams and memories, in reality and in the imaginary. I lay my claim only on one, my world, easily recognizable because it has the shape of my brain. And it has this shape because it modeled it like this from the very beginning in its own image. On its surface, there are folds and deep slopes, areas for speech and areas for understanding. But there are nowhere concrete walls, iron curtains, frontiers. And now I will kindly ask Mircea to tell us about what Blinding is to him and about, in particular, the fragment he's planning to read for us.
Thank you, Dalia, that suggested me what I was going to say. But the fact is that I really don't know and I really don't care what I'll be going to say this evening. As you know, as Wittgenstein said, if you write, the thinking appears on the paper, and if you speak, the thinking appears in the mouth. So I'm very curious what I'll be saying myself, because saying something is a question of emergency. But one thing is evident for me, that I must begin by saying good evening and by thank you very much that you came here to listen to us and to enjoy a little bit of literature and a little bit of ourselves and yourselves. I also feel the need to thank my good friend Jill for publishing this book, to thank Sean Carter, whom I haven't had the pleasure to meet so far, for doing this horrible work of translating this book, maybe even more horrible than writing it or reading it. Of course, I thank Delia for the very nice presentation she had tonight. At first, I would like to define myself a bit, what kind of creature I am. This is what I wonder each and every day of my life. But one thing is sure, I am not a writer, and I don't want to be called a writer. And I think that no writer should like to be called a writer, or to call himself or herself a writer. To be a writer, in my opinion, is a title, like to be a philosopher or to be a scholar. You cannot say this about yourself. It's a bit obscene to do it. You first have to let the years pass and to deserve it, to deserve to be called like that. I think the most important writer of all times, in my opinion, or one of the very few, Franz Kafka, was so great just because he never called himself a writer, and actually because he wasn't one. I'm only a person who writes journal. This is my best definition. I've been writing journal daily notes since I was 17, I've done it almost each and every day of my life. So I'm like a snail which leaves a trace after it, a silver trace after it, just as a testimony that it ever lived. I just love to write in my notebooks. I always write by hand. I cannot imagine other kind of literary writing but writing by hand. I think it's the most sensual connection to the naked page, to the virgin page, that you can have in this process, this erotic process of writing. I write mostly every day, as I told you, and actually what I do is cartographing, is it correct?
Mapping
actually my mind each and every day in three dimensions, or even in more dimensions, because I'm mapping it not only horizontally but in evolution, in its evolution, and I'm always crossing this mapping in all the directions to make it stronger. I just, in a way, I recreate myself on the paper, day by day, without any need of a reward, without any need of anything. I think that if I ceased writing in my journal only for a month, I think I'd die, because this is a vital function for me. And this journal is the fundamental work, let's say, that that I write, a work in progress, like a stem of my tree, and all the branches are my my books that I published so far. They have a special connection to the stem. Each of them derived at one time or another from this stem and spread divergently and bearing some fruits at the end. But the zest just passes through the stem. Everything is there. So Orbitor, one of my books, but not just one of them, is a fruit breaking the branch at the end of which it is because of its weight. It's the biggest fruit that I've ever produced. It's like a pumpkin, let's say, hanging at the end of a branch where only an apple should have been. Sometimes it's dangerous to produce such big fruits. Orbitor, which is the Romanian name for blinding, came from my wish to do two things at a time. To write a book over 1,000 pages. This one, my first idea that I had, the thickness of the book in front of, before everything else, and then to write a book called Orbitor. Orbitor in Romanian has a bit more connotations than blinding in English. Orbitor doesn't always mean a very strong light, a dazzling light, but also a mystical light. And I think here is the big difference. Jesus went on the Mount Tabor and changed his appearance, that light flowing from the Mount Tabor could be called a blinding light with the Romanian term Orbitor. Orbitor is also a palindrome, a word that could be read the other way around too, like the Ouroboros serpent which bites its tail. So it's a symbol of the totality, in a way. Anyway, I don't know why precisely, but I loved this word. And there is a very old entry in my journal, many years before having blinding on my mind, let's say, which sounded like, well, how wonderful would be if I ever wrote a novel called Orbitor. With only these two things, I started to write, and I've written in notebooks by hand with a simple pen for 14 years. I wrote almost every day for 14 years this trilogy. I want to tell you that it's a 1,500 pages book. It's not only what you see here. Here it's only a quarter of it because the other two volumes are much bigger. So it's like watching a statue from the knees down. You have the statue from the knees down here. And I've written it in 14 years, mostly abroad, where I had some scholarships or I taught at some university. So I started it in Amsterdam, where I wrote for 2 years. The first volume is completely written in Amsterdam. Then I continued it in Berlin, in Budapest, in Vienna, and in Stuttgart. The third volume is completely written in Stuttgart. I had no plan. I never had a plan. I never knew where this book actually heads to what it has. I just wrote in a sort of a process of self-hypnosis, I would say, just reading each day the previous page and writing in the same key. Of course, the themes and the subjects of this book started to create themselves. This is not a mollusk. This is not a Medusa, Hydra, but a very well structured book. But it's structured itself in a way. It's structured as in the book of Job is said. Can you know how the bones of the fetus are made themselves in the womb of a woman? It's the same. These bones made themselves. It was a sort of an origami which developed itself in my mind in a way. So when I was about at the middle of the book, I had about 40 stories that were interfering to each other, but which were open and diverging from each other. So after that, I had to close them because I couldn't leave this book running in all directions. I had to finish it in a way, to force those branches come together. So after the first half of this book, I couldn't invent all the time anymore. I had to become more focused on what I did. So my liberty was smaller and smaller to the end of the book because I had to end each and every of those 40 stories. So I had to make them click. And I heard, while writing them, I heard click, 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 40 times, and a big click above, just like sigillating a bag, a plastic bag, and then a huge click above the last click, because my book has two endings, a terrestrial one and a metaphysical one. And when I finished it, just in time, lest it finished me. I remember very well that day. It was a sunny day in Stuttgart when I wrote the end, at the end of this book. I thought I was going to die, but I didn't know of happiness, of despair. It was a mixed feeling. At the same time, happiness and despair and exhaustion. I felt myself totally exhausted. And after I finished it, for 4 years, I couldn't write any real book. I wrote some minor books in the meantime, but I couldn't do something of this value, let's say. I would define blinding as the plane carrier of my modest fleet. And I think one plane carrier in a fleet is enough. A fleet must have lots of kinds, types of ships. And sometimes at war, the tiniest boat is more valuable than a big man of war, for example. I think I will never write such a big book again. One is enough, even more than enough. In a certain preface of one of his books, Borges said, "It's crazy to write big books. It's a complete waste of time to write a book which is over 500 pages, let's say." And it's absolutely true for most of the books. Most of the novels can be resumed in only 2 pages. So why should you write 500 pages? Yes, but try to resume Lolita, Nabokov's Lolita, in 2 pages. Only an idiot can do this. Lolita and each of Nabokov's books cannot be resumed but in the same number of words that it contains. You cannot eliminate even one word without damaging everything, because in Lolita, not the plot, not the characters, not the classic parts of a book matter, but the chemistry of the words. So this molecular system of Nabokov's writing. So you cannot resume it. You cannot tell what's the subject of it. You cannot try to explain this book to some other person. You can just read it and enjoy it. Enjoy each and every line from it. I think I spoke too much, and I apologize for it. And I think it's time to read a bit from this book, because nobody believes you by word. You have, as a merchant, you have to show something to the buyers. So we'll have an échantillon, which I hope you will enjoy. I will be reading only a very short part in Romanian, and I would kindly ask Delia to read it completely in English. Ok. La 7 sau 8 ani, părinții mă culcau obligatoriu după amiază. Șifonierul era pe atunci așezat paralel cu patul și mă priveam minute în șir în luciul lui galben. Un copil cu ochii întunecați, transpirând sub ceașa.
When I was 7 or 8, my parents made me take a nap every afternoon. The dresser faced the bed, and I would watch my reflection shine on its surface, minute after minute. A child with dark eyes, sweating under his sheet, and unable to sleep even for a second. When the sun reflecting in the veneer began to blind me, making me see purple spots, I turned my face to the wall to follow every little rust-colored blossom and leaf in the pattern on the upholstered side of the bedstead cabinet. In this floral labyrinth, I discovered little symmetries, unexpected patterns, animal heads and men's silhouettes, and with these I created stories I meant to continue in my dreams. But sleep never came. There was too much light, and one October precisely, this white light convinced me to play with fire. I listened first for any sounds from my parents' room, and then I slipped out of bed and tiptoed to the window. The image of the city was dusty and far away. The street curved off toward the left, so I could see the apartments on our side, toward Lizanu and Dobor. In the distance, I could see the old fire watchtower, and behind it, a city heating plant with its parabolic tubes ejecting petrified smoke. The trees appeared straight, all like Gothic arches, but the closest ones betrayed their provenance. The branches filled with trembling, sprouting leaves were not straining, but twisted like an unfastened braid. I leaned my forehead against the window and, dizzy with insomnia, waited for 5 o'clock, but time seemed to have stopped flowing, and the terrifying image of my father bursting through the door, his head knotted in his stocking on top of his head like a fez and falling in thick line as black as a crow's tail kept coming into my head. Once, during these minutes, stolen from obligatory sleep, I contemplated the most beautiful scene in the world. It was after a summer storm, with lightning branching through the suddenly dark sky, so dark that I would not have been able to say if it was darker in my room or outside, with gusts of rain, rapid parallel streams, surrounded by a mist of fine drops, lazily bouncing in every direction. When the rain stopped, daylight appeared between the black sky and the wet great city, as if two infinitely gentle hands were protecting the yellow, fresh, transparent light that lay across these surfaces, coloring them saffron and orange and turning the air golden, making it shine like a prism. Slowly, the clouds broke apart, and other stripes of the same rarefied gold fell obliquely, crossing the initial light, making it clearer and cooler and ever more intense. spread over the hills, the metropolitan towers the color of mercury, all the windows burning like a salt flame and crowned with a rainbow. Bucharest painted itself onto my triptych window, the sash of which my collarbone just touched. My illumination would be scrapped off, and above it, in neat, compact letters, a command would be written, as heavy as a curtain. But today, at the midpoint of my life's arc, when I have read every book, and those tattooed on the moon and on my skin, even those written with the tip of a needle in the corners of my eyes, when I have seen enough and had enough, when I have systematically dismantled my five senses, when I have loved and hated, when I have raised immortal monuments in copper, when my ears have grown long awaiting our little God, without understanding for a long time that I'm just a mite burrowing my trails through his skin of old light, when angels have populated my head like spirobacteria, when all the sweetness of the world has been consumed, and when April and May and June are gone, today, when my skin flakes beneath my ring like thousands of layers of onion paper today, this vivacious and absurd today, I try to put my disorder into thought. I try to read the ruins of windows and apartment balconies full of wet laundry, the apartments across the street that broke my life in two, just like the Nautilus that walls over each outgrown compartment and moves into a larger one, inching through the ivory spiral that forms a summary of my life. But this text is not human, and I cannot understand it anymore. What remains inside, my birth, my childhood, my adolescence, seeps through the pores of the enormous wall in long, enigmatic strands, deformed, anamorphic and foreshortened, nebulized and diffracted, numberless, through which I can reach the small room where I sometimes return. Pearl over pearl over pearl, blue over blue over blue. Every age and every house where I have lived, unless it was a hallucination of nothingness, filters everything that came before, combining it all, making the bands of my life narrower and more heterogeneous. You do not describe the past by writing about old things, but by writing about the haze that exists between yourself and the past. I write about the way my present brain wraps around my brains of smaller and smaller crania of bones and cartilage and membranes, the tension and discord between my present mind and my mind a moment ago, my mind 10 years ago. Their interactions as they mix with each other's images and emotions. There's so much necrophilia in memory, so much fascination for ruin and rot, it's like being a forensic pathologist peering at liquefied organs. To conceive of myself at different ages, with so many previous lives completed, is like talking about a long, uninterrupted line of dead bodies, a tunnel of bodies dying one into the next. A moment ago, the body who was here writing the words, dying one into the next, with his face reflected in the dark pool of a coffee cup, fell off his stool. His skin crumbled away, revealing the bones of his face, and his eyes rolled out, weeping black blood. A moment from now, the one who will write, will be the next to fall into the dust of the one before. How can you enter this mausoleum, and why would you? And what mask of Tiffany, what surgical glove will protect you from the infection emanating from memory? Years later, while reading poetry or listening to music, I would feel ecstasy, the abrupt and focused clot in the brain, the sudden surge of a volatile and vesicant liquid, the window pane suddenly opening, not onto anything outside myself, but into some place surrounded by brains, something profound and unbearable, a welling up of beatitude. I had access, I had gained access to the forbidden room through poetry or music or a single thought or an image that appeared in my mind, or much later, coming home from high school by myself, stomping in puddles along the streetcar tracks, a window glint, the scent of a woman. I entered the epithalamium, I steeped myself in amygdala, I curled up in the abstract extension of the gold ring in the center of the mind. The revelation was like a cry of silent happiness. It was nothing like an orgasm except in epileptic brutality, but it expressed tranquility, love, submission, surrender, and adoration. There are breakthroughs, ruptures leading to the cistern of living light from the depths of our being, rending swirlings in the interior limit of thought, turning it into a starry heaven, since we all have this starry heaven in the skull and over it, our consciousness. Often, though, this interior ejaculation would not reach its consummation, but stop in the antechamber and the antechambers of antechambers, where it stirred flickering images that were snuffed out in a second, leaving behind regret and nostalgia that would follow me for the rest of the day. Poems, these illumination machines, debauched me. I used them like drugs until it was impossible for me to live without them. I'd started some time before to write poems too. Among so many graceful lines, enchanted and aggressive, I would find myself stringing together for no reason passages of nonsense that seemed dictated by some other being. When I reread them, they terrified me like a prophecy come true. In these, I spoke about my mother, God, childhood, just as if in the course of conversation over a beer, I had suddenly started to speak in tongues with the thin voice of a child, a castrato or an angel. My mother would appear in my poems walking down to the Fonte Almada, taller than the apartment buildings, kicking over the trucks and streetcars, crushing the sheet metal kiosk beneath her enormous heels, sweeping up passers-by in her cheap skirts. She would stop in front of the triple window of my room, crouch down and look inside. Her enormous blue eye and frowning brow filled the window and filled me with terror. Then she would stand and set off westward, her wiry, phosphorescent hair destroying postal airplanes and satellites in the sky full of blood. What was going on with this mythologizing of my mother? Nothing had ever made me feel close to her. Nothing in her interested me. She was the woman who washed my clothes, fried potatoes for me, and made me go to the university classes, even when I wanted to skip. She was Mama, a neutral being who looked neutral, who lived a modest life full of chores, and who lived in our house, where I was always a stranger. What accounted for this dearth of feeling in our family? My father was always traveling, and when he came home red-faced, stinking of sweat, he would tie his hair thick as a horse's tail on top of his head with pantyhose, with the top sagging open, a dark foot hanging between his shoulder blades. My mother would make him dinner and watch television with him, pointing out the cute folk music singers or variety show actors, gossiping about them endlessly. I'd eat quickly and retreat to the room facing the street. The other two rooms gave onto the back of the building toward the melancholy red brick Dymbovitsa flour mill, to watch the polyhedral drone of Bucharest in the window, or to write disconnected poems in graph paper notebooks, or to curl up under the blanket, pulling it over my head, as though I could not stand the humiliation and shame of being an adolescent. We were my family, three insects, each only interested in our own chemical trails, occasionally touching antennae and moving on. How did you do at school today? Fine. Your dynamo got creamed on your own turf. So what? I'm doing okay with Polytech. And then into the shell to write more lines from nowhere. Mother, the power of dreams was your gift to me. I would spend nights entire with you, eye to eye and hand in hand. I would believe I was beginning to know, and your heart would beat again for both of us, and between our crania translucent as the shells of shrimp and imaginary umbilical cord would emerge, and hypnosis and levitation and telepathy and love would be the different colors of the flowers in our arms. Together, we would play an eternal game of cards with two sides, life, death, while the clouds would flash in the fall of day, far off.
And now comes the most pleasant for me part of our event, taking questions from you.
My name is Dan, and I was curious if you ever tried to write in a foreign language than Romanian.
No. I wouldn't. My writing is deeply embedded in the Romanian language, I couldn't really do it, even if I wasn't a complete idiot in learning foreign languages, as you may have noticed. We have one of the great Romanian names is Mircea Eliade, who worked in here in Chicago as a historian of religions and anthropologist. And he was always writing his scientific work in French, in English, and so on. But he said, Romanian is the language in which I dream and in which I write literature. I'm the same in a way. It never crossed my mind to use another language for what I have to do, because I'm dreaming in Romanian, and then I'm thinking in Romanian, even if I when I speak my poor English. Actually, this is why it is poor, because I first think in Romanian, then translate it in.
Thank you for coming. My question actually is regarding something that you recently said about the Nobel Prize, how bad it would be for the Romanian culture to get a Nobel Prize or an Oscar Prize. Could you please develop that? Thank you.
Yes, as I told yesterday to other people, I am doomed to get the Nobel Prize. I have to take it. It's on my list because I promised it to my wife. 15 years ago, when she wasn't my wife yet, I had to lure her into marrying me, in a way. So I was too poor to buy her a diamond ring, and I thought that promising her to get the Nobel Prize would be cheaper. So now it was a trap. Now I have to keep my promise.
Thank you again for coming here. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and discussion featuring Romanian author Mircea Cartescu. The discussion was moderated by Delia Agriana, assistant professor at the University of Bucharest and visiting lecturer in Harvard's Department of Comparative Literature. We began with an introduction by AGNI editor Sven Berkets. Tonight's event was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal AGNI. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.